Welcome, everyone. Excuse me. Welcome, everyone, to Certain Odd Guys Menagerie of History. This is episode 16. We got three installments of Life of Abraham Lincoln from the book written by Henry Ketchum. We are live at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, May 28, 2010. Thank you all for being here. And let's get started with part 9.
Chapter 30, Lincoln and Greeley. Much of the mischief of the world is the work of people who mean well. Not the least of the annoyances thrust on Lincoln came from people who ought to have known better. The fact that such mischief makers are complacent, as if they were doing what was brilliant and useful, adds to the vexation. One of the most prominent citizens of the United States at the time of the Civil War was Horace Greeley. He was a man of ardent convictions, of unimpeachable honesty, and an editorial writer of the first rank. He did a vast amount of good. He also did a vast amount of mischief, which may be considered to offset a part of the good he accomplished. His intellectual ability made it impossible for him to be anywhere a non-entity. He was always prominent. His paper, the New York Tribune, was in many respects the ablest newspaper of the day. Large numbers of intelligent Republicans took the utterances of the Tribune as gospel truth. It is not safe for any man to have an excess of influence. It is not surprising that the wide influence which Greeley acquired made him egotistic. He apparently came to believe that he had a mortgage on the Republican Party, and through that upon the country. His editorial became dictatorial. He looked upon Lincoln as a protege of his own who required direction. This he was willing to give, mildly but firmly. All this was true of many other good men and good Republicans, but it was emphatically true of Greeley. If there is anything worse than a military man who plumes himself upon his statesmanship, it is the civilian who affects to understand military matters better than the generals, the War Department, and the Commander-in-Chief. This was Greeley. He placed his military policy in the form of a war cry, On to Richmond, at the head of his editorial page, and with a pen of marvelous power rung the changes on it. This is but one sample of a man's proneness to interfere in other matters. With all the infallibility of an editor, he was ever ready to tell what the president ought to do as a sensible and patriotic man. He would have saved the country by electing Douglas, by permitting peaceable secession, by persuading the French ambassador to intervene, by conference and argument with the Confederate emissaries, and by assuming personal control of the administration. At a later date, he went so far as to propose to force Lincoln's resignation. He did not seem to realize that Lincoln could be most effective if allowed to do his work in his own way. He did not grasp the truth that he could be of the highest value to the administration only as he helped and encouraged, and that his obstructions operated only to diminish the efficiency of the government. If Greeley had put the same degree of force into encouraging the administration that he put into hindering its work, he would have merited the gratitude of his generation. He was singularly lacking in the willingness to do this or in the ability to recognize its importance. Like hundreds of others, he persisted in expounding the duties of the executive, but his patronizing advice was more harmful in proportion to the incisiveness of his literary ability. This impertinence of Greeley's criticism reached its climax in an open letter to Lincoln. This letter is in part quoted here. It shows something of the unspeakable annoyances that were thrust upon the already overburdened president from those who ought to have delighted in holding up his hands, those of whom better things might have been expected. The reply shows the patience with which Lincoln received these criticisms. It further shows the skill with which he could meet the famous editor on his own ground, for he also could wield a trenchant pen. Greeley's letter is very long, and it is not necessary to give it in full. But the headings which are given below are quite sufficient to show that the brilliant editor dipped his pen in gall in order that he might add bitterness to the man whose life was already filled to the brim with bitter sorrows, trials, and disappointments of a distracted nation. The letter is published on the editorial page of the New York Tribune of August 20, 1862. The Prayer of 20 Millions. To Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States. Dear Sir, I do not intrude to tell you, For you must know already that a great portion of those who triumphed in your election, and of all who desire the unqualified suppression of the rebellion now desolating our country, are sorely disappointed and deeply pained by the policy you seem to be pursuing with regard to the slaves of the rebels. I write only to set succinctly and unmistakably before you what we require, what we think we have a right to expect, and of what we complain. 1. We require of you, as the first servant of the Republic, charged especially and preeminently with this duty, that you execute the laws. 2. We think you are strangely and disastrously remiss in the discharge of your official and imperative duty with regard to the emancipating provisions of the new Confiscation Act. 3. We think you are unduly influenced by the councils, the representations, the menaces of certain fossil politicians hailing from the border states. 4. We think the timid counsels of such a crisis calculated to prove perilous and probably disastrous. 5. We complain that the Union cause has suffered and is now suffering immensely from mistaken deference to rebel slavery. Had you, sir, in your inaugural address, unmistakably given notice that, in case the rebellion already commenced were persisted in, and your efforts to preserve the Union and enforce the law should be resisted by armed force, you would recognize no loyal person as rightfully held in slavery by a traitor. We believe that the rebellion would have received a staggering, if not fatal, blow. 6. We complain that the Confiscation Act which you approved is habitually disregarded by your generals, and that no word of rebuke for them from you has yet reached the public ear. 7. Let me call your attention to the recent tragedy in New Orleans, whereof the facts are obtained entirely through pro-slavery channels. 8. On the face of this wide earth, Mr. President, there is not one disinterested, determined, intelligent champion of the Union cause who does not feel that all attempts to put down the rebellion and at the same time uphold its inciting cause are preposterous and futile. That the rebellion, if crushed out tomorrow, would be renewed within a year if slavery were left in full vigor. That the army of officers who remain to this day devoted to slavery can at best be but halfway loyal to the Union. And that every hour of deference to slavery is an hour of added and deepened peril to the Union. 9. I close as I began with the statement that what an immense majority of the loyal millions of your countrymen require of you is a frank, declared, unqualified, ungrudging execution of the laws of the land, more especially of the Confiscation Act. As one of the millions who would gladly have avoided this struggle at any sacrifice but that of principle and honor, but who now feel that the triumph of the Union is indispensable not only to the existence of our country, but to the well-being of mankind, I entreat you to render a hearty and unequivocal obedience to the law of the land. Yours, Horace Greeley. New York, August 19, 1862. Those who are familiar with the eccentricities of this able editor will not be slow to believe that, had Lincoln, previous to the writing of that letter, done the very things he called for, Greeley would not improbably have been among the first to attack him with his caustic criticism. Lincoln was not ignorant of this. But he seized this opportunity to address a far wider constituency than that represented in the subscription list of the Tribune. His reply was published in the Washington Star. He put the matter so temperately and plainly that the most obtuse could not fail to see the reasonableness of it. As to Greeley, we do not hear from him again, and may assume he was silenced if not convinced. The reply was as follows. Executive Mansion, Washington, August 22, 1862. Honorable Horace Greeley. Dear Sir, I have just read yours of the 19th, addressed to myself through the New York Tribune. If there be in it any statements or assumptions of fact which I may know to be erroneous, I do not now and here controvert them. If there be in it any inferences which I may believe to be falsely drawn, I do not now and here argue against them. If there be perceptible in it an impatient and dictatorial tone, I waive it in deference to an old friend whose heart I have always supposed to be right. As to the policy I seem to be pursuing, as you say, I have not meant to leave anyone in doubt. I would save the Union. I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be the Union as it was. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe that what I am doing hurts the cause. And I shall do more whenever I shall believe doing more will help the cause. I shall try to correct errors when shown to be errors. And I shall adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty. And I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free. Yours, A. Lincoln. Not the least interesting fact connected with this subject is that at this very time Lincoln had the Emancipation Proclamation in mind. But not even the exasperating teasing that is fairly represented by Greeley's letter caused him to put forth that proclamation prematurely. It is no slight mark of greatness that he was able under so great pressure to bide his time. This was not the last of Greeley's efforts to control the president or run the machine. In 1864 he was earnestly opposed to his renomination, but finally submitted to the inevitable. In July of that year, 1864, two prominent Confederates, Clay of Alabama and Thompson of Mississippi, managed to use Greeley for their purposes. They communicated with him from Canada, professing to have authority to arrange for terms of peace, and they asked for a safe conduct to Washington. Greeley fell into the trap, but Lincoln did not. There is little doubt that their real scheme was to foment discontent and secure division throughout the North on the eve of the presidential election. Lincoln wrote to Greeley as follows: "If you can find any person anywhere professing to have authority from Jefferson Davis in writing, embracing the restoration of the Union and the abandonment of slavery, whatever else it embraces, say to him that he may come to me with you." Under date of July 18th, he wrote the following, to whom it may concern: "Any proposition which embraces the restoration of peace, the integrity of the whole Union, and the abandonment of slavery, and which comes by and with an authority that can control the armies now at war with the United States, will be received and considered by the executive government of the United States, and will be met on liberal terms on substantial and collateral points, and the bearer or bearers thereof shall have safe conduct both ways. Abraham Lincoln." Greeley met these commissioners at Niagara, but it turned out they had no authority whatever from the Confederate government. The whole affair was therefore a mere fiasco. But Greeley, who had been completely duped, was full of wrath, and persistently misrepresented, not to say maligned, the president. According to Noah Brooks, the president said of the affair, "Well, it's hardly fair to say that this won't amount to anything. It will shut up Greeley and satisfy the people who are clamoring for peace. That's something anyhow." The president was too hopeful. It did not accomplish quite that, for Greeley was very persistent, but it did prevent a serious division of the North. Chapter 31, Emancipation. The institution of slavery was always and only hateful to the earnest and honest nature of Lincoln. He detested it with all the energy of his soul. He would, as he said, gladly have swept it from the face of the earth. Not even the extreme abolitionists, Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Whittier, abominated slavery with more intensity than Lincoln. But he did not show his hostility in the same way. He had a wider scope of vision than they. He had, and they had not, an appreciative historical knowledge of slavery in this country. He knew that it was tolerated by the Constitution and laws enacted within the provisions of the Constitution, though he believed that the later expansion of slavery was contrary to the spirit and intent of the men who framed the Constitution. And he believed that slaveholders had legal rights which should be respected by all orderly citizens. His sympathy with the slave did not cripple his consideration for the slave owner, who had inherited his property in that form, and under a constitution and laws which he did not originate and for which he was not responsible. He would destroy slavery root and branch, but he would do it in a manner conformable to the Constitution, not in violation of it. He would exterminate it, but he would not so do it as to impoverish law-abiding citizens whose property was in slaves. He would eliminate slavery, but not in a way to destroy the country, for that would entail more mischief than benefit. To use a figure, he would throw Jonah overboard, but he would not upset the ship in the act. Large numbers of people have a limited scope of knowledge. Such overlook the real benefits of our civilization and did not realize that wrecking the Constitution would simply destroy the good that had thus far been achieved and uproot the seeds of promise of usefulness for the centuries to come. They wanted slavery destroyed at once, violently, regardless of disastrous consequences. On the other hand, Lincoln wanted it destroyed, but by a sure and rational process. He wished, and from this he never swerved, to do also two things. First, to compensate the owners of the slaves, and second, to provide for the future of the slaves themselves. Of course, the extreme radicals could not realize that he was more intensely opposed to slavery than themselves. Let us now glance at his record. We have already seen how he revolted from the first view of the horrors of the institution, and the youthful vow which he there recorded will not readily be forgotten. That was in 1831, when he was 22 years of age. 6 years later, or in 1837, when he was a youthful member of the Illinois legislature, he persuaded Stone to join him in a protest against slavery. There was positively nothing to be gained by this protest, either personally or in behalf of the slave. The only possible reason for it was that he believed that slavery was wrong and could not rest until he had openly expressed that belief. A timely utterance gave that thought relief, and I again am strong. When he was in Congress in 1846, the famous Wilmot Proviso came up. This was to provide that, as an express and fundamental condition to the acquisition of any territory from the Republic of Mexico by the United States, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall ever exist in any part of the said territory. By reason of amendments, this subject came before the House very many times, and Lincoln said afterward that he had voted for the proviso in one form or another 42 times. On the 16th day of January, 1849, he introduced into Congress a bill for the emancipation of slavery in the District of Columbia. This was a wise and reasonable bill. It gave justice to all, and at the same time gathered all the fruits of emancipation in the best possible way. The bill did not pass. There was no hope at the time that it would pass. But it compelled a reasonable discussion of the subject and had a certain amount of educational influence. It is interesting that 13 years later, April 10th, 1862, he had the privilege of fixing his presidential signature to a bill similar to his own. Congress had moved up to his position. When he signed the bill, he said, "Little did I dream in 1849, when I proposed to abolish slavery in this capital and could scarcely get a hearing for the proposition, that it would be so soon accomplished." After the expiration of his term in Congress, he left political life, he supposed, forever. He went into the practice of law in earnest and was so engaged at the time of the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, which called him back to the arena of politics. In the early part of the war, there were certain attempts at emancipation which Lincoln held in check for the reason that the time for them had not arrived. There's a tide in the affairs of men. It is of prime importance that this tide be taken at the flood. So far as emancipation was concerned, this came in slower than the eagerness of Generals Fremont and Hunter. But it was coming, and in the meantime Lincoln was doing what he could to help matters on. The difficulty was that if the Union was destroyed, it would be the death blow to the cause of emancipation. At the same time, not a few loyal men were slaveholders. To alienate these by premature action would be disastrous. The only wise plan of action was to wait patiently until sufficient numbers of these could be depended on in the emergency of emancipation. This was what Lincoln was doing. The first part of the year, 1862, was very trying. The North had expected to march rapidly and triumphantly into Richmond. This had not been accomplished, but on the contrary, disaster had followed disaster in battle. And after many months, the two armies were encamped facing each other and almost in sight of Washington, while the soldiers from the North were rapidly sickening and dying in Southern camps. Small wonder if there was an impatient clamor. A serious result of this delay was the danger arising from European sources. The monarchies of Europe had no sympathy with American freedom. They became impatient with reports of no progress in the war, and at this time, some of them were watching for a pretext to recognize the Southern Confederacy. This came vividly to the knowledge of Carl Schurz, minister to Spain. By permission of the president, he returned to this country, this was late in January 1862, to lay the matter personally before him. With the help of Schurz, Lincoln proceeded to develop the sentiment for emancipation. By his request, Schurz went to New York to address a meeting of the Emancipation Society on March 6th. It need not be said that the speaker delivered a most able and eloquent plea upon emancipation as a peace measure. Lincoln also made a marked contribution to the meeting. He telegraphed to Schurz the text of his message to Congress recommending emancipation in the District of Columbia, which resulted in the law already mentioned, and this message of Lincoln was read to the meeting. The effect of it, following the speech of Schurz, was overwhelming. It was quite enough to satisfy the most sanguine expectations. This was not a coincidence. It was a plan. Lincoln's hand in the whole matter was not seen nor suspected for many years after. It gave a marked impetus to the sentiment of emancipation. To the loyal slaveholders of the border states, he made a proposal of compensated emancipation. To his great disappointment, they rejected this. It was very foolish on their part, and he cautioned them that they might find worse trouble. All this time, while holding back the eager spirits of the abolitionists, he was preparing for his final stroke. But it was of capital importance that this should not be premature. McClellan's failure to take Richmond and his persistent delay hastened the result. The community at large became impatient beyond all bounds. There came about a feeling that something radical must be done, and that quickly. But it was still necessary that he should be patient. As the bravest fireman is the last to leave the burning structure, so the wise statesman must hold himself in check until the success of so important a measure is assured beyond a doubt. An event which occurred later may be narrated here because it illustrates the feeling which Lincoln always had in regard to slavery. The item was written out by the president himself and given to the newspapers for publication under the heading, "The President's Last, Shortest, and Best Speech." On Thursday of last week, two ladies from Tennessee came before the president asking the release of their husbands held as prisoners of war at Johnson's Island. They were put off until Friday when they came again and were again put off until Saturday. At each of the interviews, one of the ladies urged that her husband was a religious man. On Saturday, when the president ordered the release of the prisoners, he said to this lady, "You say your husband is a religious man. Tell him when you meet him that I say I am not much of a judge of religion, but that in my opinion, the religion that sets men to rebel and fight against their government because, as they think, that government does not sufficiently help some men to eat their bread in the sweat of other men's faces, is not the sort of religion upon which people can get to heaven." As the dreadful summer of 1862 advanced, Lincoln noted surely that the time was at hand when emancipation would be the master stroke. In discussing the possibilities of this measure, he seemed to take the opposite side. This was a fixed habit with him. He drew out the thoughts of other people. He was enabled to see the subject from all sides. Even after his mind was made up to do a certain thing, he would still argue against it. But in any other sense than this, he took counsel of no one upon the emancipation measure. The work was his work. He presented his tentative proclamation to the cabinet on the 22nd of July, 1862. The rest of the story is best told in Lincoln's own words. It had got to be midsummer, 1862. Things had gone on from bad to worse, until I felt that we had reached the end of our rope on the plan of operations we had been pursuing, that we had about played our last card, and must change our tactics or lose the game. I now determined upon the adoption of the emancipation policy, and without consultation with or knowledge of the cabinet, I prepared the original draft of the proclamation, and after much anxious thought called a cabinet meeting upon the subject. I said to the cabinet that I had resolved upon this step, and had not called them together to ask their advice, but to lay the subject matter of a proclamation before them, suggestions as to which would be in order after they had heard it read. The members of the cabinet offered various suggestions, but none which Lincoln had not fully anticipated. Seward approved the message, but thought the time was not opportune. There had been so many reverses in the war that he feared the effect. It may be viewed, he said, as the last measure of an exhausted government, a cry for help, the government stretching forth its hands to Ethiopia instead of Ethiopia stretching forth her hands to the government. He then suggested that the proclamation be not issued until it could be given to the country supported by military successes. This seemed to Lincoln a wise suggestion, and he acted on it. The document was laid away for the time. It was not until September 17th that the looked-for success came. The Confederate Army had crossed the Potomac with the intention of invading the North. They were met and completely defeated in the Battle of Antietam. Lincoln said of it, "When Lee came over the river, I made a resolution that if McClellan drove him back, I would send the proclamation after him." The Battle of Antietam was fought Wednesday, and until Saturday I could not find out whether we had gained a victory or lost a battle. It was then too late to issue the proclamation that day. And the fact is, I fixed it up a little Sunday, and Monday I let them have it. This was the preliminary proclamation, and was issued September 22nd. The supplementary document, the real proclamation of emancipation, was issued January 1st, 1863. As the latter covers substantially the ground of the former, it is not necessary to repeat both, and only the second one is given. Emancipation Proclamation. Whereas on the 22nd day of September, in the year of our Lord 1862, a proclamation was issued by the President of the United States, containing among other things the following, to wit: that on the first day of January in the year of our Lord 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforth, and forever free, and the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons, and will do no act or acts to repress such persons or any of them in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom. That the executive will, on the first day of January aforesaid by proclamation, designate the states and part of states, if any, in which the people thereof respectively shall then be in rebellion against the United States, and the fact that any state or the people thereof shall on that day be in good faith represented in Congress of the United States by members chosen thereto at elections wherein a majority of the disqualified voters of such state shall have participated, shall in the absence of strong countervailing testimony be deemed conclusive evidence that such state and the people thereof are not then in rebellion against the United States. Now, therefore, I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, by virtue of the power in me vested as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, in time of actual armed rebellion against the authority of and government of the United States, and as a fit and necessary war measure for suppressing said rebellion, do on this first day of January, in the year of our Lord, 1863, and in accordance with my purpose so to do, publicly proclaim for the full period of 100 days from the day first above mentioned, order and designate, as the states and parts of states wherein the people thereof respectively are this day in rebellion against the United States, here follows the list, and by virtue of the power and for the purpose aforesaid, I do order and declare that all persons held as slaves within said designated states and parts of states are and henceforth shall be free, and that the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authorities thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedoms of said persons. And I hereby enjoin upon the people so declared to be free to abstain from all violence, unless in necessary self-defense, and I recommend to them that in all cases when allowed, they labor faithfully for reasonable wages. And I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition will be received into the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, positions, stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service. And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerable judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. In testimony whereof, I have hereunto set my name and caused the seal of the United States to be affixed. Done at the city of Washington, this first day of January, in the year of our Lord, 1863, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 87th. Abraham Lincoln. By the President, William H. Seward, Secretary of State. So he fulfilled his youthful vow. He had hit that thing, and he had hit it hard. From that blow, the cursed institution of slavery will not recover in 1,000 years. Chapter 32. Discouragement. The middle period of the war was gloomy and discouraging. Though the Confederates made no substantial progress, they certainly held their own. Time is an important factor in all history, and the fact that the Confederates at least gained time counted heavily against the Union. There were no decisive victories gained by the Federal troops. Antietam, to be sure, was won, but the fruits of the victory were lost. For many months the two armies continued facing each other, and for the most part they were much nearer Washington than Richmond. Meantime, the summer, fall, winter were passing by, and there was no tangible evidence that the government would ever be able to maintain its authority. All this time the Army of the Potomac was magnificent in numbers, equipment, intelligence. In every respect but one, they were decidedly superior to the enemy. The one thing they needed was leadership. The South had generals of the first grade. The generalship of the North had not yet fully developed. Lincoln held on to McClellan as long as it was possible to do so. He never resented the personal discourtesies. He never wearied of the fruitless task of urging him on. He never refused to let him have his own way, provided he could show a reason for it. But his persistent inactivity wore out the patience of the country, and finally of the army itself. With the exception of Northern Democrats with Southern sympathies, who from the first were sure of only one thing, namely that the war was a failure, the clamor for the removal of McClellan was well nigh unanimous. To this clamor Lincoln yielded only when it became manifestly foolish longer to resist it. A succeeding question was no less important. Who shall take his place? There was in the East no general whose record would entitle him to this position of honor and responsibility. In all the country there was at that time no one whose successes were so conspicuous as to point him out as the coming man. But there were generals who had done good service, and just at that time. Burnside was at the height of his success. He was accordingly appointed. His record was good. He was an unusually handsome man, of soldierly bearing, and possessed many valuable qualities. He was warmly welcomed by the country at large and by his own army, who thanked God and took courage. His first battle as commander of the Army of the Potomac was fought at Fredericksburg on the 15th of December and resulted in his being repulsed with terrible slaughter. It is possible in this, as in every other battle, that had certain things been a little different, had it been possible to fight the battle 3 weeks earlier, he would have won a glorious victory. But these thoughts do not bring to life the men who were slain in battle, nor do they quiet the clamor of the country. Burnside showed a certain persistence when, in disregard of the unanimous judgment of his generals, he tried to force a march through the heavy roads of Virginia as sticky as glue and give battle again. But he got stuck in the mud and the plan was given up, the only casualty being the death of a large number of mules that were killed trying to draw wagons through the bottomless mud. After this one battle, it was plain that Burnside was not the coming general. The next experiment was with Hooker, a valiant and able man whose warlike qualities are suggested by his well-earned sobriquet of Fighting Joe Hooker. He had his limitations, as will presently appear. But upon appointing him to the command, Lincoln wrote him a personal letter. This letter is here reproduced because it is a perfect illustration of the kindly patience of the man who had need of so much patience. Executive Mansion, Washington, D.C., January 26, 1863. Major General Hooker. General, I have placed you at the head of the Army of the Potomac. Of course I have done this upon what appears to me to be sufficient reasons. And yet I think it best for you to know that there are some things in regard to which I am not satisfied with you. I believe you to be a brave and skillful soldier, which of course I like. I also believe that you do not mix politics with your profession, in which you are right. You have confidence in yourself, which is a valuable if not indispensable quality. You are ambitious, which within reason does good rather than harm. But I think that during General Burnside's command of the army, you have taken counsel of your ambition and thwarted him as much as you could, in which you did a great wrong to the country and to a most meritorious and honorable brother officer. I have heard in such a way as to believe it of you recently saying that both the army and the government need a dictator. Of course it was not for this, but in spite of it, that I have given you the command. Only those generals who gain success can be dictators. What I now ask of you is military success, and I will risk the dictatorship. The government will support you to the utmost of its ability, which is neither more nor less than it has done and will do for all commanders. I much fear that the spirit you have aimed to infuse into the army of criticizing their commander and withholding confidence from him will now turn upon you. I shall assist you as far as I can to put it down. Neither you nor Napoleon, if he were alive again, could get any good out of an army while such a spirit prevails in it. And now, beware of rashness. Beware of rashness, but with energy and sleepless vigilance, go forward and give us victories. Yours very truly, A. Lincoln. The first effect of this letter was to subdue the factious spirit of the fighter. He said, "That is just such a letter as a father might write to a son. It is a beautiful letter, and although I think he was harder on me than I deserved, I will say that I love the man who wrote it." But later his conceit took possession of him. According to Noah Brooks, he said to some friends, "I suppose you have seen this letter or a copy of it." They had. "After I had been to Richmond, I shall have the letter published in the newspapers. It will be amusing." When this was told Lincoln, he took the good-natured view of it and only said, "Poor Hooker, I am afraid he is incorrigible." It was in January 1863 that Hooker took command of the army. 3 months later he had it in shape for the campaign, and Lincoln went down to see the review. It was indeed a magnificent army, an inspiring sight. But it was noticed by many that Lincoln's face had not the joyous radiancy of hope which it had formerly worn. It was positively haggard. It was plain he did not share his general's easy confidence. He could not forget that he had more than once seen an army magnificent before battle and shattered after battle. He spent a week there, talking with the generals, shaking hands with the boys. Many a private soldier of that day carries to this day as a sacred memory the earnest sound of the president's voice, "God bless you." Then came Chancellorsville with its sickening consequences. When the news came to Washington, the president, with streaming eyes, could only exclaim, "My God, my God, what will the country say?" The next we hear of Hooker, he had not entered Richmond, nor had he found the amusement of publishing the president's fatherly letter. He was chasing Lee in a northerly direction, towards Philadelphia or New York. He became angry with Halleck, who refused him something and summarily resigned. It was not, for the country, an opportune time for changing generals, but perhaps it was as well. It certainly shows that, while Lincoln took him as the best material at hand, while he counseled, encouraged, and bore with him, yet his diagnosis of Hooker's foibles was correct, and his fears, not his hopes, were realized. He was succeeded by George C. Meade, Four-Eyed George, as he was playfully called by his loyal soldiers, in allusion to his eyeglasses. It was only a few days later that the Great Battle of Gettysburg was fought under Meade, and a brilliant victory was achieved. But here, as at Antietam, the triumph was bitterly marred by the disappointment that followed. The victorious army let the defeated army get away. The excuses were about the same as at Antietam. The troops were tired. Of course they were tired. But it may be assumed that the defeated army was also tired. It surely makes one army quite as tired to suffer defeat as it makes the other to achieve victory. It was again a golden opportunity to destroy Lee's army and end the war. Perhaps Meade had achieved enough for one man in winning Gettysburg. It would not be strange if the 3 days' battle had left him with nerves unstrung. The fact remains that he did not pursue and annihilate the defeated army. They were permitted to recross the Potomac without molestation, to re-enter what may be called their own territory, to reorganize, rest, re-equip, and in due time to reappear as formidable as ever. It is plain that the hero of Gettysburg was not the man destined to crush the rebellion. Here were three men, Burnside, Hooker, and Meade, all good men and gallant soldiers. But not one of them was able successfully to command so large an army or to do the thing most needed, capture Richmond. The future hero had not yet won the attention of the country. In the meantime, affairs were very dark for the administration, and up to the summer of 1863 had been growing darker and darker. Some splendid military successes had been accomplished in the West, but the West is at best a vague term even to this day, and it has always seemed so remote from the capital, especially as compared to the limited theater of war in Virginia, where the Confederate army was almost always within sight of the capital, that these Western victories did not have as much influence as they should have had. And there were signal reverses in the West, too. Both Louisville and Cincinnati were seriously threatened, and the Battle of Chickamauga was another field of slaughter, even though it was shortly redeemed by Chattanooga. But the attention of the country was necessarily focused chiefly on the limited territory that lay between Washington and Richmond. In that region, nothing permanent or decisive had been accomplished in the period of more than 2 years, and it is a small wonder that the president became haggard in appearance. He did what he could. He had thus far held the divided North and prevented a European alliance with the Confederates. He now used one by one the most extreme measures. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus, declared or authorized martial law, authorized the confiscation of the property of those who were providing aid and comfort for the enemy, called for troops by conscription when volunteers ceased, and enlisted Negro troops. Anyone who studies the character of Abraham Lincoln will realize that these measures, or most of them, came from him with great reluctance. He was not a man who would readily or lightly take up such means. They meant that the country was pressed, hard pressed. They were extreme measures, not congenial to his accustomed lines of thought. They were as necessities. But what Lincoln looked for, longed for, was the man who could use skillfully and successfully the great army of the Potomac. He had not yet been discovered.
Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Before I continue to part 10, I wanted to remind you to join General Rachel and I at 9 p.m. on Eastern Time on Sunday for the 107th edition of the Patriot Hour, or excuse me, 106th edition, where we try to make sense of all this nonsense. Before I continue on to part 10 of the life of Abraham Lincoln, let's play a little song here to break it up. now for part 10 from the book, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum.
Chapter 33, New Hopes. The outlook from Washington during the first half of the year 1863 was as discouraging as could well be borne. There had been no real advance since the beginning of the war. Young men, loyal and enthusiastic, had gone into the army by hundreds of thousands. Large numbers of these, the flowers of the northern youth, had been slain or wounded, and far larger numbers had died of exposure in the swamps of Virginia. There was still no progress. Washington had been defended, but there was hardly a day when the Confederates were not within menacing distance of the capital. After the bloody disaster at Chancellorsville, matters grew even worse. Lee first defeated Hooker in battle, and then he outmaneuvered him. He cleverly eluded him, and before Hooker was aware of what was going on, he was on his way with 80,000 men towards Philadelphia and had nearly a week's start of the Union Army. The Confederates had always thought that if they could carry the war into the northern states, they would fight to better advantage. Jeff Davis had threatened the torch, but it is not likely that such subordinates as General Lee shared his destructive and barbarous ambition. Still, Lee had a magnificent army, and its presence in Pennsylvania was fitted to inspire terror. It was also fitted to rouse the martial spirits of the northern soldiers, as afterwards appeared. As soon as the situation was known, Hooker started in hot pursuit. After he had crossed the Potomac going north, he made certain requests of the War Department which were refused, and he, angry at the refusal, promptly sent in his resignation. Whether his requests were reasonable is one question. Whether it was patriotic in him to resign on the eve of what was certain to be a great and decisive battle is another question. But his resignation was accepted, and Meade was appointed to the command. He accepted the responsibility with a modest and soldierly spirit and acquit himself like a man. It is one of the rare cases in all history in which an army has on the eve of battle made a change of generals without a disaster. That is surely highly to the credit of General Meade. Lee's objective point was not known. He might capture Harrisburg or Philadelphia or both. He would probably desire to cut off all communication with Washington. The only thing to do was to overtake him and force a battle. He himself realized this and was fully decided not to give a battle but fight only on the defensive. Curiously enough, Meade also decided not to attack but to fight on the defensive. Nevertheless, the best laid schemes. The result was Gettysburg, and the battle was not fought in accordance with the plan of either commander. Uncontrollable events forced the battle then and there. This battlefield was some distance to the north, that is to say, in advance of Pipe Creek, the location selected by Meade. But a conflict between a considerable force on each side opened the famous battle on July 1st. A retreat or withdrawal to Pipe Creek would have been disastrous. The first clash was between Heth's division on the Confederate side and Buford and Reynolds on the Union side. Rarely have soldiers been more eager for the fray than those were of the Union Army at this time, especially the sons of Pennsylvania. Up and at 'em was the universal feeling. It was hardly possible to hold them back. The generals felt that it was not wise to hold them back. Thus, as one division after another on both sides came up to the help of their comrades, Gettysburg was accepted as the battlefield. It was selected by neither commander. It was thrust upon them by the fortunes of war. It was selected by the god of battles. Almost the first victim on the Union side was that talented and brave soldier, the general in command, Reynolds. His place was later in the day, that is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, filled and well filled by General Hancock. The scope of this volume does not permit the description of this great battle, and only some of the results may be given. The evening of July 1st closed in with the Union Army holding out, but with the advantages such as they were on the Confederate side. The second day the fight was fiercely renewed and closed with no special advantage on either side. On the third day it was still undecided, until in the afternoon when the climax came in Pickett's famous charge. This was the very flower of the Confederate Army, and the hazard of the charge was taken by General Lee against the earnest advice of Longstreet. They were repulsed and routed, and that decided the battle. Lee's army was turned back. The attempted invasion was a failure, and it became manifest that even Lee could not fight to advantage on northern soil. Gettysburg was the greatest battle ever fought on the Western Hemisphere, and it will easily rank as one of the greatest battles of either hemisphere. The number of troops was about 80,000 on each side. In the beginning, the Confederates decidedly outnumbered the Federals because the latter were more scattered and it took time to bring them up. In the latter part, the numbers were more nearly evenly divided, though nearly one-fourth of Meade's men were not in the battle at any time. The total loss of killed, wounded, and missing was on the Confederate side over 31,000, on the Union side about 23,000. The Confederates lost 17 generals, and the Federals 20. When we consider this loss of generals, bearing in mind that on the Union side they were mostly those on whom Meade would naturally lean, it is hardly to be wondered at that he so far lost his nerve as to be unwilling to pursue the retreating enemy or hazard another battle. He could not realize that the enemy had suffered much more than he had, and that despite his losses, he was in a condition to destroy that army. Not all that Lincoln could say availed to persuade him to renew the attack upon the retreating foe. When Lee reached the Potomac, he found the river so swollen as to be impassable. He could only wait for the waters to subside or for time to improvise upon Tunbridge. When, after waiting for 10 days, Meade was aroused to make the attack, he was just one day too late. Lee had got his army safely into Virginia, and the war was not over. Lincoln could only say, "Providence has twice," the other references to Antietam, "delivered the Army of Northern Virginia into our hands, and with such opportunities lost, we ought scarcely to hope for a third chance." Lincoln wrote a letter to Meade. He also wrote him a second letter, or was it the first, which he did not send. We quote from this because it really expressed the President's mind, and because the fact that he did not send it only shows how reluctant he was to wound another's feelings, even when deserved. "Again, my dear General, I do not believe you appreciate the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. He was within your easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with our other late successes, have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely. If you could not safely attack Lee last Monday, how can you possibly do so south of the river when you can take with you very few more than two-thirds of the force you then had in hand? It would be unreasonable to expect, and I do not expect, that you can now effect much. Your golden opportunity is gone, and I am distressed immeasurably because of it. I beg you will not consider this a prosecution or persecution of yourself. As you had learned that I was dissatisfied, I thought it best to kindly tell you why." While not overlooking Meade's omission, as this letter shows, he appreciated the full value of the victory that checked Lee's advance, and thanked the general heartily for that. On the same afternoon of July 3rd, almost at the very minute that Pickett was making his charge, there was in progress, 1,000 miles to the west, an event of almost equal importance. Just outside the fortifications of Vicksburg, under an oak tree, General Grant had met the Confederate General Pemberton to negotiate terms of surrender. The siege of Vicksburg was a great triumph, and its capitulation was of scarcely less importance than the victory at Gettysburg. Vicksburg commanded the Mississippi River and was supposed to be impregnable. Surely few cities were situated more favorably to resist either attack or siege. But Admiral Porter got his gunboats below the city, running the batteries in the night, and Grant's investment was complete. The Confederate cause was hopeless, their men nearly starved. Grant's plan was to make a final attack, if necessary, on the 6th or 7th day of July. But sometime previous to this, he had predicted that the garrison would surrender on the 4th. General Pemberton tried his utmost to avoid this very thing. When it became apparent that he could not hold out much longer, he opened negotiations on the morning of July 3rd for the specific purpose of forestalling the possibility of surrender on the next day, Independence Day. In his report to the Confederate government, he claims to have chosen the 4th of July for surrender because he thought that he could secure better terms on that day. But his pompous word has little weight, and all the evidence points the other way. When, on the morning of the 3rd of July, he opened negotiations, he could not possibly have foreseen that it would take 24 hours to arrange the terms. It was then on the 4th of July that Grant occupied Vicksburg. The account by Nicolay and Hay ends with the following beautiful reflection. It is not the least of the glories gained by the Army of the Tennessee in this wonderful campaign that not a single cheer went up from the Union ranks. Not a single word was spoken that could offend their beaten foes. The loss to the Union Army in killed, wounded, and missing was about 9,000. The Confederate loss was nearly 50,000. To be sure, many of the paroled were compelled to reenlist according to the policy of the Confederate government. But even so, their parole was a good thing for the cause of the Union. They were so thoroughly disaffected that their release did for the time more harm than good to the Southern cause. Then it left Grant's army free. The sequel to this victory came 10 months later in Sherman's march to the sea, not less thrilling in its conception and dramatic in its execution than any battle or siege. Much fighting, skillful generalship, long patience were required before this crowning act could be done. But it came in due time and was one of the finishing blows to the Confederacy. And it came as a logical result of the colossal victory at Vicksburg. There were some eddies and countercurrents to the main drift of affairs. About the time that Lee and his beaten army were making good their escape, terrific riots broke out in New York City in resisting the draft. As is usual in mob rule, the very worst elements of human or devilish depravity come to the top and were most in evidence. For several days there was indeed a reign of terror. The fury of the mob was directed particularly against the Negroes. They were murdered. Their orphan asylum was burnt. But the government quickly suppressed the riot with a firm hand. The feeling was general throughout the country that we were now on the way to a successful issue of the war. The end was almost in sight. Gettysburg and Vicksburg, July 3rd and 4th, 1863, had inspired new hopes never to be quenched. On the 15th day of July, the President issued a Thanksgiving proclamation, designating August 6th as the day. Later in the year, he issued another Thanksgiving proclamation, designating the last Thursday in November. Previous to that time, certain states, and not a few individuals, were in the habit of observing a Thanksgiving Day in November. Indeed, the custom, in a desultory way, dates back to Plymouth Colony. But these irregular and uncertain observances never took on the semblance of a national holiday. That dates from the proclamation issued October 3, 1863. From that day to this, every president has every year followed that example. Lincoln was invited to attend a public meeting appointed for August 26th at his own city of Springfield, the object of which was to concert measures for the maintenance of the Union. The pressure of public duties did not permit him to leave Washington, but he wrote a characteristic letter, a part of which refers to some of the events touched on in this chapter. A few sentences of this letter are here given. The Father of Waters again goes unvexed to the sea, thanks to the great Northwest for it, nor yet wholly to them. 300 miles tip they meet New England, Empire, Keystone, and Jersey, hewing their way right and left. The sunny South, too, in more colors than one, also lent a helping hand. On the spot their part of history was jotted down in black and white. The job was a great national one, and let none be slighted who bore an honorable part in it. And while those who have cleared the great river may well be proud, even that is not all. It is hard to say that anything has been done more bravely and well done than at Antietam, Murfreesboro, Gettysburg, and on many fields of less note. Nor must Uncle Sam's webbed feet be forgotten. At all the watery margins they have been present, not only in the deep sea, the broad bay, and the rapid river, but also up the narrow, muddy bayou, and wherever the ground was a little damp, they had been and made their tracks. Thanks to all. For the great Republic, for the principle it lives by and keeps alive, for man's vast future, thanks to all. Peace does not appear so distant as it did. I hope it will come soon and come to stay, and so come as to be worth the keeping in all future time. It will then have been proved that among freemen there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet, and that they who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. And there will be some black men who can remember that with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind on to this great consumption. While I fear that there will be some white ones unable to forget that with malignant heart and deceitful speech they have striven to hinder it. It is plain that after July 4, 1863, the final result was no longer doubtful. So Lincoln felt it. There were indeed some who continued to cry that the war was a failure. But in such cases, the wish was only father to the thought. Chapter 34, Lincoln and Grant. The great army of Robert E. Lee operated through the whole period of the 4 years of the war, almost within sight of Washington City. It is not in the least strange that Eastern men, many of whom had hardly crossed the Alleghanies, should think that the operations in Virginia were about all the war there was, and that the fighting in the West was of subordinate importance. Lincoln could not fall into this error. Not only had he a singularly broad vision, but he himself was a Western man. He fully appreciated the magnitude of the operations in that vast territory lying between the Alleghanies on the east and the western boundary of Missouri on the west. He also clearly understood the importance of keeping open the Mississippi River throughout its entire length. At the very time the Army of the Potomac was apparently doing nothing, winning no victories, destroying no armies, making no permanent advances, there was a man in the West who was building up for himself a remarkable reputation. He was all the while winning victories, destroying armies, making advances. He was always active. He was always successful. The instant one thing was accomplished, he turned his energies to a new task. This was Grant. He was a graduate of West Point, had seen service in the Mexican War, and ultimately rose to the grade of captain. At the outbreak of the war, he was in business with his father in Galena, Illinois. When the president called for the 75,000 men, Grant proceeded at once to make himself useful by drilling volunteer troops. He was by the governor of Illinois commissioned as colonel and was soon promoted. His first service was in Missouri. When stationed at Cairo, he seized Paducah on his own responsibility. This stroke possibly saved Kentucky for the Union. For the legislature, which had up to that time been wavering, declared at once in favor of the Union. He was then ordered to break up a Confederate force at Belmont, a few miles below Cairo. He started at once on his expedition, and though the enemy was largely reinforced before his arrival, he was entirely successful, and returned with victory, not excuses. Then came Forts Henry and Donelson. The latter attracted unusual attention because it was the most important Union victory up to that time, and because of his epigrammatic reply to the offer of surrender. When asked what terms he would allow, his reply was, "Unconditional surrender." As these initials happened to fit the initials of his name, he was for a long time called Unconditional Surrender Grant. So he passed promptly from one task to another, from one victory to another, and Lincoln kept watch of him. He began to think that Grant was the man for the army. It has been said that Lincoln, while he gave general directions to his soldiers and freely offered suggestions, left them to work out the military details in their own way. This is so well illustrated in his letter to Grant that, for this reason, as well as for the intrinsic interest of the letter, it is here given in full. "My dear General, I do not remember that you and I ever met personally. I write this now as a grateful acknowledgment for the almost inestimable service you have done the country. I wish to say a word further. When you first reached the vicinity of Vicksburg, I thought you should do what you finally did. March the troops across the neck, run the batteries with the transports, and thus go below. And I never had any faith, except a general hope that you knew better than I, that the Yazoo Pass expedition and the like could succeed. When you got below and took Port Gibson, Grand Gulf, and vicinity, I thought you should go down the river and join General Banks. And when you turned northward, east of the Big Black, I thought it was a mistake. I now wish to make the personal acknowledgement that you were right and I was wrong. There was surely no call for this confession, no reason for the letter except the bigness of the heart of the writer. Like the letter to Hooker, it was just such a letter as a father might write a son. It was the production of a high grade of manliness. Prominence always brings envy, fault-finding, hostility. From this, Grant did not escape. The more brilliant and uniform his successes, the more clamorous a certain class of people became. The more strictly he attended to his soldierly duties, the more busily certain people tried to interfere, to tell him how to do and how not to do. In their self-appointed censorship, they even besieged the president and made life a burden to him. With wit and unfailing good nature, he turned their criticisms. When they argued that Grant could not possibly be a good soldier, he replied, "I like him. He fights." When they charged him with drunkenness, Lincoln jocularly proposed that they ascertain the brand of the whiskey he drank and buy up a large amount of the same sort to send to his other generals, so that they might win victories like him. Grant's important victories in the West came in rapid and brilliant succession. Forts Henry and Donelson were captured in February 1862. The Battle of Shiloh, or Pittsburgh Landing, was fought in April of the same year. Vicksburg surrendered July 4, 1863, and the Battle of Chattanooga took place in November of that year. Grant was always sparing of words, and his reports were puzzling to the administration. He always reported, and that promptly. But his reports were of the briefest description, and in such marked contrast to those of all other officers known to the government, that they were a mystery to those familiar with certain others. Lincoln said that Grant could do anything except write a report. He concluded to send a trustworthy messenger to see what manner of man this victorious general was. Charles A. Dana, Assistant Secretary of War, was chosen for this purpose. His investigation was satisfactory, fully so. Lincoln's confidence in and hopes for this rising warrior were fully justified. It was after the capitulation of Vicksburg that Grant grasped the fact that he was the man destined to end the war. After the Battle of Chattanooga, public opinion generally pointed to him as the general who was to lead our armies to ultimate victory. In February 1864, Congress passed an act creating the office of Lieutenant General. The President approved that act on Washington's birthday and nominated Grant for that office. The Senate confirmed this nomination on March 2nd, and Grant was ordered to report.
Sorry about the cutoff on that one. Hopefully it'll pick up on episode 11. I'd like to remind you once again to listen in on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 106th edition of the Patriot Hour, where General H and I try to make sense of all this nonsense. Before I continue on with episode 11 from the book, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum, I'm going to play a little tribute song written by Glenn Miller called American Patrol.
Thank you.
From the book, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum.
Chapter 36, Second Election. It was Lincoln's lifelong habit to keep himself close to the plain people. He loved them. He declared that the Lord must love them, or he would not have made so many of them. Out of them he came, to them he belonged. In youth he was the perennial peacemaker and umpire of disputes in his rural neighborhood. When he was president, the same people instinctively turned to him for help. The servants called him Old Abe, from them a term of affection. The soldiers called him Father Abraham. He was glad to receive renowned politicians and prominent businessmen at the White House. He was more glad to see the plain people. When a farmer neighbor addressed him as Mr. President, he said, "Call me Lincoln." The friendship of these people rested him. Then, too, he had a profound realization of their importance to the national prosperity. It was their instincts that constituted the national conscience. It was their votes that had elected him. It was their muskets that had defended the Capitol. It was on their loyalty that he counted for the ultimate triumph of the Union cause. As his administrative policy progressed, it was his concern not to outstrip them so far as to lose their support. In other words, he was to lead them, not run away from them. His confidence in them was on the whole well-founded, though there were times when the ground seemed to be slipping out from under him. The middle portion of 1864 was one such period of discouragement. The material for volunteer soldiers was about exhausted, and it was becoming more and more necessary to depend upon the draft, and that measure caused much friction. The war had been long, costly, sorrowful. Grant was before Petersburg, Farragut at Mobile, and Sherman at Atlanta. The two first had no promise of immediate success, and as to the third, it was a question whether he was not caught in his own trap. This prolongation of the war had a bad effect on the northern public. Lincoln shrewdly and fairly analyzed the factions of loyal people as follows. We are in civil war. In such cases, there is always a main question. But in this case, that question is a perplexing compound, union and slavery. It thus becomes a question not of two sides merely, but of at least four sides, even among those who are for the union, saying nothing of those who are against it. Thus, those who are for the union with, but not without, slavery. Those for it without, but not with. Those for it with or without, but prefer it with, and those for it with or without, but prefer it without. Among these again is a subdivision of those who are for gradual but not immediate, and those who are for immediate but not for gradual extinction of slavery. One man who was in the political schemes of that day says that in Washington there were only three prominent politicians who were not seriously discontented with and opposed to Lincoln. The three named were Conkling, Sumner, and Wilson. Though there were undoubtedly a large number who remained loyal to their chief, yet the discontent was general. The president himself felt this. Nicolay and Hay have published a note which impressively tells the sorrowful story. Executive Mansion, Washington, August 28, 1864. This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be re-elected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterward. A. Lincoln. Early in the year, this discontent had broken out in a disagreeable and dangerous form. The malcontents were casting about to find a candidate who would defeat Lincoln. They first tried General Rosecrans, and from him they got an answer of no uncertain sound. "My place," he declared, "is here. the country gave me my education and so has a right to my military services. Their next attempt was Grant, with whom they fared no better. Then they tried Vice President Hamlin, who was certainly dissatisfied with the slowness with which Lincoln moved in the direction of abolition. But Hamlin would not be a candidate against his chief. Then the Secretary of the Treasury, Chase, entered the race as a rival of Lincoln. When this became known, the President was urged by his friends to dismiss from the Cabinet this Secretary who was so far out of sympathy with the administration he was serving. He refused to do this so long as Chase did his official duties well, and when Chase offered to resign, he told them there was no need of it. But the citizens of Ohio, of which state Chase had in 1860 been the favored son, did not take the same view of the matter. Both legislature and mass meetings demanded his resignation so emphatically that he could not refuse. He did resign and was for a short time in private life. In December 1864, Lincoln, in the full knowledge of the fact that during the summer Chase had done his utmost to injure him, nominated him as Chief Justice, and from him received his oath of office at his second inaugural. The search for a rival for Lincoln was more successful when Fremont was solicited. He was nominated by a convention of extreme abolitionists that met in the city of Cleveland. But it soon became apparent that his following was insignificant, and he withdrew his name. The regular Republican convention was held in Baltimore, June 8, 1864. Lincoln's name was presented, as in 1860, by the state of Illinois. On the first ballot, he received every vote except those from the state of Missouri. When this was done, the Missouri delegates changed their votes, and he was nominated unanimously. In reply to congratulations, he said, "I do not allow myself to suppose that either the convention or the league have concluded to decide that I am either the greatest or best man in America, but rather that they have concluded that it is not best to swap horses while crossing the river, and have further concluded that I am not so poor a horse that they might not make a botch of it trying to swap." That homely figure of swapping horses while crossing the river caught the attention of the country. It is doubtful if ever a campaign speech or any series of campaign speeches was so effective in winning and holding votes as that one phrase. But as has already been said, the prospects during the summer, for there was a period of 5 months from the nomination to the election, were anything but cheering. At this crisis there developed a means of vigorous support which had not previously been estimated at its full value. In every loyal state there was a war governor. Upon these men the burdens of war had rested so heavily that they understood, as they would not otherwise have understood, the superlative weight of cares that pressed on the President, and they saw more clearly than they otherwise could have seen the danger in swapping horses while crossing the river. These war governors rallied with unanimity and with great earnestness to the support of the President. Other willing helpers were used. The plain people, as well as the leading patriots, rallied to the support of the President. The Democrats nominated McClellan on the general theory that the war was a failure. As Election Day approached, the increased vigor with which the war was prosecuted made it look less like a failure, even though success was not in sight. The result of the election was what in later days would be called a landslide. There were 233 electors. Of this number, 212 were for Lincoln. The loyal North was back of him. He might now confidently gird himself for finishing the work. Such was his kindliness of spirit that he was not unduly elated by success, and never, either in trial or achievement, did he become vindictive or revengeful. After the election, he was serenaded, and in acknowledgment he made a little speech. Among other things, he said, "Now that the election is over, may not all, having a common interest, reunite in a common effort to save our common country. For my own part, I have striven and will strive to place no obstacle in the way. So long as I have been here, I have not willingly planted a thorn in any man's bosom." Chapter 37, Close of the War. As the year 1864 wore towards its close, military events manifestly approached a climax. In 1861, the two armies were comparatively green. For obvious reasons, the advantage was on the side of the South. The South had so long been in substantial control at Washington that they had the majority of the generals. They had nearly all the arms and ammunition, and since they had planned the coming conflict, their militia were in the main in better condition. But matters were different after 3 years. The armies on both sides were now composed of veterans. The generals had been tried, and their value was known. Not least of all, Washington, while by no means free from spies, was not so completely overrun with them as at the first. At the beginning, the departments were simply full of spies, and every movement of the government was promptly reported to the authorities at Richmond. 3.5 years had sufficed to weed out most of these. In that period, a splendid navy had been constructed. The Mississippi River was open from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. Every southern port was more or less successfully blockaded, and the power of the government in this was every month growing stronger. Strange as it may seem, the available population of the North had increased. The figures which Lincoln gave prove this. The loyal states of the North gave in 1860 a sum total of 3,870,222 votes. The same states in 1864 gave a total of 3,982,011. That gave an excess of voters to the number of 111,789. To this should be added the number of all the soldiers in the field from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Delaware, Indiana, Illinois, and California, who by the laws of their states could not vote away from their homes, and which number could not have been less than 90,000. Then there were two new states, Kansas and Nevada, that had cast 33,762 votes. This leaves an increase from the North of 234,551 votes. It is plain that the North was not becoming exhausted of men. Nor had the manufacturers of the North decreased. The manufacture of arms and all the munitions of war was continually improving, and the other industrial interests were flourishing. There was indeed much poverty and great suffering. The financial problem was one of the most serious of all. But in all these, the South was suffering more than the North. On the southern side, matters were growing desperate. The factor of time now counted against them, for except in military discipline, they were not improving with the passing years. There was little hope of foreign intervention. There was not much hope of a counter-uprising in the North. It is now generally accepted as a certainty that if the Confederate government had published the truth concerning the progress of the war, especially of such battles as Chattanooga, the Southern people would have recognized the hopelessness of their cause and the wickedness of additional slaughter, and the war would have terminated sooner. In the 8th volume of the history by Nicolai and Hay, there is a succession of chapters of which the headings alone tell the glad story of progress. These headings are Arkansas Free, Louisiana Free, Tennessee Free, Maryland Free, and Missouri Free. In August, Admiral Farragut had captured Mobile. General Grant with his veterans was face to face with General Lee and his veterans in Virginia. General Sherman with his splendid army had in the early fall struck through the territory of the Southern Confederacy and on Christmas Day had captured Savannah. The following letter from the President again shows his friendliness toward his generals. Executive Mansion, Washington, December 26, 1864. My dear General Sherman, many, many thanks for your Christmas gift, the capture of Savannah. When you were about leaving Atlanta for the Atlantic, I was anxious, if not fearful, but feeling that you were the better judge, and remembering that nothing risked, nothing gained, I did not interfere. Now the undertaking being a success, the honor is all yours, for I believe that none of us went further than to acquiesce. And taking the work of General Thomas into the count, as it should be taken, it is indeed a great success. Not only does it afford the obvious and immediate military advantages, but in showing to the world that your army could be divided, putting the stronger part to an important new service, and yet leaving enough to vanquish the old opposing force of the whole, Hood's army, it brings those who sat in darkness to see a great light. But what next? I suppose it will be safe if I leave General Grant and yourself to decide. Please make my grateful acknowledgement to your whole army, officers and men. Yours very truly, A. Lincoln. The principal thing now to be done was the destruction of the Confederate army or armies in Virginia. That and that only could end the war. The sooner it should be done, the better. Grant's spirit cannot in 100 pages be better expressed than in his own epigram, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer." It did take all summer, and all winter too, for the Confederates as well as the Federals had grown to be good fighters, and they were no cowards. They too were now acting on the defensive, and were able to take advantage of swamp, hill, and river. This was an important factor. Grant had indeed captured 2 armies and destroyed 1, but this was different. It needed not an experienced eye or military training to see that this could only be done at a costly sacrifice of life. But let it be remembered that the 3 years of no progress had also been at a costly sacrifice of life. The deadly malaria of Virginia swamps was quite as dangerous as a bullet or bayonet. Thousands upon thousands of soldiers were taken to the hospital, cursing in their wrath. If I could have only been shot on the field of battle, there would have been some glory in it. But to die of drinking the swamp water, this is awful. The sacrifice of life under Grant was appalling, but it was not greater than the other sort of sacrifice had been. What is more, it accomplished its purpose. Inch by inch he fought his way through many bloody months to the evacuation of Richmond and the surrender of Lee's army at Appomattox, April 9, 1865. Then the war was over. The sympathies of the President were not limited to his own friends or his own army. The author is permitted to narrate the following incident, doubtless there were many others like it, which is given by an eyewitness, the Reverend Lysander Dickerman, D.D. of New York City. It was at Hatcher's Run the last Sunday before the close of the war. A detachment of Confederate prisoners, possibly 2,000 in all, had just been brought in. They were in rags, starved, sick, and altogether as wretched a sight as one would be willing to see in a lifetime. A train of cars was standing on the siding. The President came out of a car and stood on the platform. As he gazed at the pitiable sufferers, he said not a word, but his breast heaved with emotion, his frame quivered. The tears streamed down his cheek, and he raised his arm. "I don't suppose," commented the doctor, "he had a handkerchief," and with his sleeve wiped away the tears. Then he silently returned, re-entered the car, which but for him was empty, sat down on the further side, buried his face in his hands, and wept. That is the picture of the man Lincoln. Little did the Southerners suspect, as they in turn cursed and maligned that great and tender man, what a noble friend they really had in him. As the end came in sight, an awkward question arose. What should we do with Jeff Davis if we catch him? This reminded the President of a little story. "I told Grant," he said, "the story of an Irishman who had taken Father Matthew's pledge. Soon thereafter, becoming very thirsty, he slipped into a saloon and applied for a lemonade. And whilst it was being mixed, he whispered to the bartender, 'If ye could drop a bit of brandy in it, all unbeknown to myself, I'd make no fuss about it.' My notion was that if Grant could let Jeff Davis escape, all unbeknownst to himself, he was to let him go. I didn't want him." Subsequent events proved the sterling wisdom of this suggestion, for the country had no use for Jeff Davis when he was caught. Late in March, 1865, the President decided to take a short vacation, said to be the first he had had since entering the White House in 1861. With a few friends, he went to City Point on the James River, where Grant had his headquarters. General Sherman came up for a conference. The two generals were confident that the end of the war was near, but they were also certain that there must be at least one more great battle. "Avoid this if possible," said the President. "No more bloodshed. No more bloodshed." On the second day of April, both Richmond and Petersburg were evacuated. The President was determined to see Richmond and started under the care of Admiral Porter. The river was tortuous, and all knew that the channel was full of obstructions, so that they had the sensation of being in suspense as to the danger of torpedoes and other devices. Admiral Farragut, who was in Richmond, came down the river on the same day, April 4th, to meet the presidential party. An accident happened to his boat, and it swung across the channel and there stuck fast, completely obstructing the channel and rendering progress in either direction impossible. The members of the presidential party were impatient and decided to proceed
don't know what happened with those last two, but they both cut off. Join me in General Rico on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 106th edition of the Patriot Hour, where we try to make sense of all this nonsense. Plus, we will be doing a tribute for Memorial Day. And I hope all of you have a great Memorial Day weekend, and thank you all for being here tonight. And to pay my own little tribute to Memorial Day, is Mansions of the Lord, sung by the West Point Glee Club. Good night, everyone.